You're listening to the station that takes you off the beaten track from the University of Victoria, CFUV, 101.9 FM, 104.3 on cable, and on the internet, cfuv.uvic.ca.
Welcome to Guerrilla Radio on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria, 104.3 on the cable, and cfuv.uvic.ca around the world in Shoutcast. 4 weeks have passed now since the devastating earthquake that rocked Haiti. The American invasion, pretending to be an aid mission, is well entrenched. Thousands of U.S. and international soldiers have secured the air and seaports and now have a stranglehold on aid as it arrives. That is, when they allow it to arrive. Across the country, people are still dying for lack of basics like potable water, food, and medicines. The corporate and state media brigades that arrived in the days after January 12th have petered out now. Only a handful remain to witness the desertion of the Haitian people, and with it, the last vestige of the ruling Western elite's pretense to humanity. As with the phony promised change in America, for Haitians it is the same as it ever was. The people are being ground underfoot by want and cruelty, while their deliverance lays behind barbed wire, jealously guarded by beasts in service to insatiable greed. Ezelie Danto is a Haitian-American playwright, performance poet, and author. She's also a social and political activist and commentator and human rights attorney. And she is founder and president of the Haitian Lawyers Leadership Network and serves, too, as managing editor of the online journal Haitian Perspectives and publishes the Ezelie Danto newsletter, Ezelie Danto and Day 27 in New Haiti in the first half. And one watershed at a time, Vancouver Island is fast on its way to becoming an environmental wasteland. This time, the wreckers have their eyes on Shaunigan Lake's watershed, where the plan, what else but suburban sprawl into the already plundered forest lands. Typically, this systemic erasure of wild space is called development. But there are some telling differences with what's being planned around Shaunigan. Mary Desmond is president of the Shaunigan Lake Watershed Watch Association and says this fight is about more than losing natural habitat and rural lifestyle. Mary Desmond and Staying the Vandal's Hand in the second half, and Victoria Street News publisher and CFUV broadcaster Janine Bancroft will be here at the bottom of the hour to bring us news straight from the streets of Victoria and environs. But first, Ezelie Danto and Haiti in year one. Stick around. Well, welcome to the show, Ezelie.
Thank you very much, Chris. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, my pleasure, of course. Now, as I mentioned, it's day 27 in Haiti. What news do you have from your friends, family, and contacts in Haiti today?
Well, today I spend most of the time trying to get aid, water, food to various places in Haiti and coordinating, really, for our folks to reach areas that are asking for help and they're not getting it. I can tell you at around 6 o'clock this afternoon, I wrote out a piece for the Ezelie Danto Network because one of our collaborators in Haiti, Carl Telemach, called and said that he has 1,500 children that he's looking after in his area in a place called Kouadebouke, Haiti, and that they are not getting any sort of aid. He said the small little amount of food and water that they do get, they must stand in long, long lines, and at points in time, they are required to run long distances because the food is just dropped out in the air, and they have to run to go get it. And he basically was saying to me that this is very, very humiliating. His concern, just like the concern of most of the folks I spoke to today, was that they did not have anything, medicine, food, water. They felt that people were being left to die. Some of them could see the stockpiles of the World Relief Organizations of food and water, but they're just stockpiling them and deciding to when or how to make the distribution. And Haitians feel like they are just children, because they could do the distribution. They know where the folks are where it is most needed. I must say that one of the things that Carl asked me to tell the world the next time I was on the radio or in any place where others would be listening is that Carl is at this in Quadébouquet in his area. He has a truck, so he's been driving from Quadébouquet, which is about 10-12 hours to the Dominican Republic, to get folks who are very 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 sick help. But he tells me that everyone that he's brought, many of the folks that he's brought to the Dominican Republic for help, they come back with limbs missing. That you have a small little wound and they're just cutting your fingers, cutting your arm, just cutting, and that's just exasperating more the tragedy, because the medicines that they should have for post-op, I'm not a doctor, so I might not say this correctly, but coagulating medicine so that there wouldn't be blood clots where they cut your limb, they don't have any post-op, so most people are dying after these limbs are cut off.
Jesus.
So basically, the urgency for us this evening at the Haitian Lawyers Leadership is these 1,500 people who are desperately in need. He tells me that the little babies have no baby food. He needs tents. He needs medicine, and we're trying to get a doctor there. So basically, to tell you the truth, Chris, what it is that Haitians are the ones that are trying to save each other. The international community is putting a show on for the cameras, and now that the cameras are gone, they're going back to their regular thing of hoarding the food and holding on to it and playing turf wars with the USAID, the UN, and the military. They're fighting amongst each other for territory and turf. And our people are just dying. So we're doing whatever we can with the little amount of resources we have. I have a network of about 10,000 subscribers. We reach maybe a couple of million people. And we're hoping folks will help this evening with Carl's immediate problem. But I have to say that it's an overall problem. That I have a lawyer that I spoke to earlier this morning around 4 a.m. who was just besides herself, saying that they are letting the people die, they are letting the people die.
Well, how do people help here now? Now, we've seen scandals with the Red Cross, which seems to be the norm for that organization in these kinds of situations. As you say, the aid is just sitting there behind armed guards at the airport or in other places where people can't get at it. How can people here that want to help that still recall? I mean, the media dropping the ball on this. I mean, as is their want, they move on. But how can our listeners help?
Well, please, go to my, we're so overwhelmed, we're so over capacity, but we have at the Esri.org blog where I try to put some of this information that I just told you, also on our website at the Esri.org.com, that's EZILIDANTO.com, there's a what to do right now. Because we've gone through so many crises, we certainly have the phases down. You know, the first phase, obviously, is search and rescue, and that didn't really work because the United States, by the time it got there, it was turning back necessary first responders. So a lot of folks, I can tell you, if they have 200,000 people dead or a corpse that they've located, from what I saw when I was in Haiti, about 5 days ago, there has to be at least twice that many still under the rubble, who died unnecessarily because if folks had gotten there, perhaps they could have helped, and Haitians were trying to do it with their hands. We have on the website, we're supporting the largest Haitian doctor group. It's Haitian Physicians Abroad. They have been there since Wednesday. Those that didn't die at the university who are doctors, they rushed over to the general hospital, and they're the ones that have been helping as much as possible. We are sending them weekly new doctors to help. So if anyone wants to help us, we are a Haitian-led, Haitian capacity organization. We support Haitians who are on the ground. Folks who know, you know, call us to tell us some of the pockets and areas where there's no one there. So you can make a donation to the Haitian Lawyers Leadership Relief Fund. You can contact the doctors directly who are taking in other doctors who can help. There's a list of medicines and so forth that are necessary that they need to replenish what they're doing. For us, this is obviously a long-term situation. You know, we're not there for the cameras. But I can tell you these doctors have been the most heroic. You won't see them on television. You know, they're not Anderson Cooper or the other guy, Gutpa, who really did do a decent job at some levels. They are out here. If you want to support them, go to our website. You see our piece where it says conscious relief with human rights and dignity. And to the best of our ability, it's not big, but it's what we can do. And we would like to have the world support it because, you know, most people are sending their money to the Red Cross or to Wyclef or to, you know, people who look at the UN and the World Relief Organization as if they are actually doing what they say they're doing. But the UN has been in Haiti for 6 years now. The situation for Haitians has only gotten worse. So we don't expect any different from them. We know what they did, for instance, during the 4 back-to-back hurricanes in 2008. Food just rotted that people collected. They just rotted at their distribution centers. So we're trying to do what we can. Whatever support that your listeners would like to give us, they can go to the website. As I said, they can either help with the medicine or help with monies that we are using to help the grassroots and people like Carl who was calling me today.
And again, that's Ezili Danto. That's EZILIDANTO.com. Well, Ezili, you mentioned Anderson Cooper. You're in the United States right now. You're getting American media. How does the media that you watch in the United States, how does it differ from the reality that you've witnessed on the ground in Haiti and from conversations with people that you know there?
Well, I don't watch the U.S. media, but from what I see...
There you are, touche.
But from what I've been told, you know, I do read a lot of their texts. You know, I remember in the day after the... I keep saying hurricane because that's what we're used to. Mm-hmm. The day after the earthquake... Someone said to me, the United States is doing a yeoman job. And, you know, I was in Haiti at the time. And you know, literally, Haitians were trying to lift up concrete with their bare hands. And you couldn't see one, anyone there that came from America or any of the 10,000 charitable NGOs that are supposed to be in Haiti to give us aid that use Haitian poverty. I call them the poverty pimps. You know, to have a pension plan and all those other things that they do. They're salaried charity workers. I didn't see any of them on the streets when I was in Haiti 4 or 5 days after the earthquake. And by the time I did see some of the UN troops, you know, they were walking around as if there was a war going on.
Yeah.
When what really people needed was someone to lift up those concrete off of the folks that were still alive. So there's a disconnect with regards to what, and I'm not saying that there hasn't been some very wonderful help. I have to mention that before the United States took over the airport, the Haitians who were there, even with the tower damaged, they were landing planes, and our first plane for the doctors landed at the airport on Wednesday. The other people that landed before the and were landed by, I think, You know, we had Israel, we had Belgium, we had even Iceland made it to Haiti way before the United States did. We had, who else did we have? You know, those folks did such a wonderful job because they were there. They had the search and rescue teams. Like I said, Israel came with a field hospital. But on Tuesday, when the on Thursday, 2 days after the earthquake, when the United States got there, that's when the blockage really started. The blockage of turning back doctors to the Dominican Republic, turning back field hospitals. I think the French had a field hospital that they were coming in with. Turning back CARICOM, I think it's especially cruel as because everyone knows that when there's an emergency and a house collapse, if you're going to save anybody, you're going to have to do it within the first 48 hours for maximum 72 hours. So then turning back folks at that point in time and saying that security was their priority is, to me, the most inhumane thing I have. I think it's a crime against humanity, because how could security be the thing? And so you block the airports, you deny first responders entry, and you're landing military in a country that is not at war with anyone, but suffering a horrible, unfathomable devastation. I mean, the last earthquake in Haiti, in Port-au-Prince, was 239 years ago. The people are not used to this. This is, it's just totally, when I say unfathomable, I mean that, you know, every building that you ever knew in your life, in your childhood, in Port-au-Prince, is just gone. And the shock of that, just looking at that, paralyzes. So how could the people even be violent? How could there be a security question? I mean, at that point in time, there was none of that. So that's one of the things that you don't see, really, because the media got there, actually, before the military, and they were just showing all of the devastation. So there's that difference. In terms of Haitian media, you know, it's the same cry. We can't get to Haiti. Haitians right now, for instance, in addition to blocking the aid because they've taken over the airport, now there's no commercial flights into Haiti. So if Haitians have family, and all of us have family, I have first cousins who we're still looking for. One third of our people that we work with at the Haitian Lawyers Leadership Network under the Anthony Dantel Witness Project are dead. One third. So we have family, we have bereavement, and yet the United States has decided by itself that Haitians can't land in Haiti. So, for instance, the only way we can get to Haiti right now is by going the long way around through the Dominican Republic. If you're a doctor and you just want to help, the USAID is requiring that you become a subcontractor to the Red Cross and go through the Red Cross. And doctors who had already been here before these procedures were put into place are not having it. Haitian doctors are not having it. It's like, you know, this is my country. This is my family. I'm in this hospital. I don't need your military. Because a couple of, I think it was like by Sunday of the after the earthquake, the Tuesday earthquake, the Americans parachuted in a show of force inside the National Palace yard, and the people were like sitting on they didn't even have tents by then. They were just like sitting in the public space because there were so many aftershocks. You know, I don't know, the last count I heard was over 30 aftershocks. So whatever building that was left, nobody was going inside of them, so they were outside. And 100 of the 82nd Airborne Marines parachuted down. It was. I'm told, an amazing sight. Now, here's. I'll give you an example. When I was there, there was this tiny little girl. One of her feet were crushed flat, and she had no painkillers, no nothing. And her mom had put a tourniquet to stop the bleeding. And so imagine these people are sitting there. They've lost everything, and what they're watching the United States parachute 100 men. And one of the men who I later spoke to, who were sitting there in front of the palace, said to me, you know, they could have at least stopped by and gave us some water. They passed them in their military outfit and said they were going up to the hospital to give security. And now our doctors have been there all of this time. They didn't need security. What the folks needed was medicine, food, and water. But this is the sort of thing that they're getting, you know, this military presence.
Well, didn't they set up a headquarters in the hospital and displace the medical staff?
Yeah, they just you know, went and the insulting, you know. Anyways, we've been insulted for so long, it's just ridiculous. But what they did was there was one of our doctors was there. He had been there 24/7 since Wednesday. Very, very exhausted, but he was obviously helping the Haitian doctors who had come from the university, those that didn't die, who had been working 24/7. So, but when the Americans came, all of a sudden, you know, they were in charge, and they were telling these doctors they were in charge. So, I mean, those are the things we're dealing with. At the same time, as we have to deal with all of the it's not anything a human being can actually process. That, you know, you might have been speaking to someone 2 hours before, and that person is gone. And you don't know where that person is. You don't know if that person is still under the rubble or if somehow someone had, you know, taken the body and dumped it off into some mass grave. You just don't know. We have put together a 14-point plan for Haiti on behalf of Haiti, and it's something that it's not new for me, because as the lawyer for President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who was Haiti's first democratically elected president, back in 1994, I worked with the Supreme Court Justice, and we were putting together a judicial reform agenda for Haiti, where we were envisioning how we would institutionalize the rule of law and provide public infrastructure work and all of that. And all of this, President Aristide and those that had worked with him on this rebuilding of Haiti had put together in a book called Investing in Human Beings, called the White Book. And that's also where folks can find the map that shows all of the various minerals and oil. Yes. and mining stuff that there is in Haiti. And their vision was to use that to build roads and communication networks and electricity and schools and literacy programs and health programs and all of that. So I've had that experience for, I don't know, since 1994. So it's not, it was, I mean, you know, we Haitians have been trying very, very hard to change the paradigm in Haiti. But the Western imperialists, they do not want us to, because the NGOs masturbate on black pain, and they make their living off of that pain, off of writing grants, and off of the colonial narrative. And the United States does not want Haiti to develop for various reasons, but for the economic reason is that they know that this particular volcanic eruption called the Island of Haiti, specifically at the western side where we are, has minerals that are strategic. We are, as you know, Chris, I don't know if you've read some of the work that I've stuff. We are under three tectonic plates, where when it rubs together, what comes up is these minerals, this oil, this, so all of this stuff. So they know that this exists in Haiti. They basically made the oil explorations back in the 50s and closed the wells, because the oil cartels in America did not want the competition. They thought that, you know, at some point, 50 years from now, these are going to be our strategic interests. So Haiti's resources is the West's strategic interest. So my people die. They keep these things hidden. When Duvalier fell and they saw that there was going to be a revolution where the people would not be excluded from politics, would want to have participation in the assets of the country, they spent since 91 till now destroying President Aristide, demonizing him, and primarily, as I show, and I've been trying to show this for years, primarily because they know what was in the White Book. They know that President Aristide wanted to use the assets of the country for the benefit of the people, and so they were always scared that President Aristide might nationalize the resources of Haiti the way that Venezuela has, or Cuba, and so that was their concern, and that was their reasons for getting rid of Bush. The first got rid of President Aristide after his seven months after his election in 1990, and then Bush the second in 2004. So that's basically where we are. Haiti is a strategic place because we lie to the north of Venezuela and to the east of Cuba. As you know, in 2008, Cuba found a very big cachet of a reservoir of oil, and has been negotiating with Russia and China to help it exploit it. That really bothers the United States. To them, what they want right now is Haiti as their base for both to be against the Cubans and the Venezuelans, and of course to make transshipments and other things that they can with Haiti's deep water ports. So those 20,000 soldiers, just like the 9,000 soldiers that were already the help that was in Haiti since 2004, are not there for human rights of Haitians, are not there to protect anything for Haitians, but they're there to protect U.S. strategic interests behind this earthquake.
Well, sadly, there's tons more that I'd like to get into, and I barely scratched the surface of my notes. Yes, I have been reading your stuff and republishing it up at pacificfreepress.com. You can go there if you're computer capable to check out and get the links. Again, it's ezilidanto.com, EZILIDANTO.com, to find out more about this and how you can help if you have a mind to. I'm going to keep on covering this story, Ezilie, and next week I'll hopefully get a hold of Kevin Pina, who is inside, a freelance filmmaker and journalist, and find out what he's seeing on the ground there. But we're not going to give up on this just yet. Thanks so much for coming on the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. And I also want to thank you very, very much for publishing our stuff. It's really, really helpful to get our stuff out there. And so thank you, Pacific Free Press, for doing that. And Chris, I appreciate all of that you do for us.
Well, I wish I could be more. Well, I'm going to take a brief break now. Thanks again, Ezilie. I'm going to take a brief break now.
Pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye. And when I come back, I'll be joined by Janine, all things being equal. So do stick around.
The Friends of Canadian Broadcasting are pleased to announce the 2010 Dalton Camp Award. The award provides a $5,000 prize to each of up to two winners of an essay competition on the link between democratic values and the media in Canada. The deadline for entries is March 15, 2010. To view the official rules, past essay winners, and a video biography on the Dalton Camp, check out their website at daltoncampaward.ca.
And welcome back to Guerrilla Radio, CFUV 101.9 FM, 104.3 on the cable, and cfuv.uvic.ca everywhere else in the world. Joining me now, as oft time she does, is Janine Bancroft. Hey, Janine.
Cool singalaf, Chris.
Sorry?
Do you remember what that means? Cool singalaf. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it properly.
No. What's that?
We learned that at the rally on Saturday.
Oh, right. Of course. There you go. That's the name of the Bastion Square, the Hanging Square, in the native dialect.
This is it. Yes, we gathered at Bastion Square on the weekend and pinned a eviction notice to the VANOC offices, whatever they're doing in Victoria, in what we knew as Bastion Square, but apparently it's Kuosingalas. And this is, yes, where the courthouse was and Judge Begbie, the hanging judge, hung.
Well, isn't it VANOC Square now?
It's going to be VANOC, the province, soon, I think.
Yeah, British VANOC.
I don't know, but I watched the Weather Channel today just for a few minutes, and have you heard about the big storm in the east?
They're getting a lot of snow, that's all I heard.
Again, the eastern seaboard, yeah, Washington. I mean, thousands of people are without power, and they're showing just mountains of snow. It's the sunny day after the blizzard, and they're shoveling the snow. And then they go to Vancouver. And they have aerial photos from January, actually. They don't really have anything current. And then they talk about the weather problems in Vancouver where there is no snow.
Hmm.
Yes, and apparently above zero temperatures expected all this week, and maybe some rain. And then they did mention that, you know, that snow is being shipped in by truck and helicopter and that sort of thing. But it's funny that they use the word problem regarding Vancouver, but I don't think they use that word, although, you know, they were sympathetic with what's going on in the east. But the power of language, hey?
Well,
so I'm thinking...
Well, I was just going to say it's going to be the first promise that Vanock has made and actually kept. They promised it would be the greenest Olympics ever, and it looks like it's pretty green.
Ah, this is true. It's the spirit of Harriet, for sure. I'm hoping that, you know, in Vancouver, I'm thinking it would be really interesting if the Native people were to sort of put signposts up with all their traditional names. You know, people... don't really stop to think a lot about what happened. You know, there were these people living here quite happily, fishing and hunting and looking after themselves and their families and living relatively, I would guess, cooperatively and, you know, sharing resources and, yeah, their troubles like any culture. But, and then along comes this other culture. You know, when I was walking at Willow's Beach on the weekend, Chris, there's a nice sort of signage saying how this used to be. It used to be a huge Native village all the way along Willow's Beach, right up to the marina, basically. And then, but the wording again, they say that these people moved to you know, different areas,
just
right?
Like the Palestinians moved of their own free accord, right?
Right. Yeah, it's just amazing, the power of language. So, and you've heard about this journalist now who's not going to be allowed, or hasn't been allowed in to Canada, right?
I saw something briefly on that. They were blocked a la Amy Goodman, except for they kept this one right out.
Yes, and he was on Democracy Now! Today speaking
Oh, boy, I talk about holding a grudge, eh? I mean, Amy's not going to let that go.
Oh, and so she shouldn't. I mean, this is the power of the word and journalism. And, you know, they want certain messages are allowed to go out and then other messages not so much, right?
Well, I
so,
understand that every British journalist is going to have a hard time now because they've been just writing terrible stuff about Vanock and scalping huge prices for internet access. They're charging them hundreds of dollars to get a pass for the 2-week internet access, and it's got the British press and I guess other foreign press just livid.
Well, you know what I would suggest is that people go to the Media Co-op, the Vancouver Media Co-op. I don't have the website right handy, but I did notice on their website today that they have an information page for traveling journalists. And they're also going to have, in the Woodward's building, there's going to be an area for alternative media people to rent space. You know, I think it's like $20 a day or something. You can get internet and that kind of thing. So there's a whole alternative media hub there. So I suppose if I were crossing the border, you know, I'd do what Stephen Colbert is doing and just get on a team or pretend you're on a team and don't carry any anti-Olympic propaganda. But I believe, Chris, I believe this is stolen Native land, and you know, we got to be allowed to report on that. And so in the spirit of freedom of the press, there's the Canwest Cowichan Citizen newspaper has been stolen, and I'm wondering if this has anything to do with your second guest. Apparently, a whole bunch of newsstands in Mill Bay and the Malahat, Shawnigan Lake, and Cobble Hill were raided, and the Citizen papers removed.
Well, that's bizarre. Are they on?
Well, and they sort of suggest that it has to do with this article that was published, which I'm having a look at. It's all to do with sort of internal politics and incorporation study committees and who, you know, what's going on behind closed doors. And this article sort of names names. And so whoever sent the press release is suggesting that it may be connected.
Do they have an online presence as well?
Well, no, but it was a letter to this Cowichan Valley Citizen. Oh, I guess so. Yeah. So yeah, it is an online paper. It's www.canada.com and then Cowichan Valley Citizen.
Cowichan Valley Citizen. So a search will find that. Oh, wow.
Yeah. I mean,
you can steal the, this sounds like sort of turn of the previous century stuff where you go out and steal all the newspapers because Boss Tweed, you know, there's something in there that he doesn't want getting out. This is amazing.
Well, we don't know. I mean, we don't want to, you know, point fingers, but the folks who sent the press release, they feel that it's somehow connected to this. So I don't know if that's...
Well, you can find that at press release at Pacific Free Press tonight when I get home. That'll be the first thing to go up. Holy
All
smokes.
Right. Well, thanks to Patrick for... Oh, no, I got that from somewhere else. I'll have to send that to you. It wasn't from our program manager, who does also send lots of good stuff. So just a couple of other things. The Ernst Young and Arenda have submitted their business case recommendations. Whoever Ernst Young and Arenda are and why they are recommending what we're supposed to do with our liquid waste management, otherwise known as sewage. But it's released, and so we've got two open houses coming up February 10th at the Ambrosia Event Center at 3 to 8 p.m. and February 11th, 3 to 8 p.m. at the Emmanuel Baptist Church on Cedar Hill Crossroad. It's really important that the public get involved and say that we want this kept in public hands. You can also go to the CRD website, and there's a survey asking for any comments.
Okay, Janine, well, your paper, the Street News, the Victoria Street News, hasn't all been stolen because it's not in boxes. Vendors, actual people sell them just like in the old days. And your show alternating Thursday mornings, 11 a.m. right here at CFUV, The Winds of Change. Are you on this week or is it next?
No, I'm hoping not to get arrested in Vancouver this week.
Oh, you're off to the zoo. Okay. All right, Janine, well, we're running late, so thanks a lot.
Thank you, Chris.
Okay, until the next time. Now I'm going to take another brief break, but when I come back, as Janine was saying, there's going on out Cowichan Way, and my next guest, Mary Desmond, is going to tell us a little bit about what's happening up Shawnigan Way, and do stick around for that.
Then I step the fuck out the frying pan. See, I'm a good cook, right, man? Chili peppers, yeah, I'll take them. And juicy birds, all right, I'll bake them. Make up a soup, yum, yum, so we all can move along like culture. What's done is done, goodbye congestion. I just got one simple suggestion. Forsake the answer, rename the question. What lies deep enough not to be mentioned? Should be brought to the top to be spoken. Even though you may have been real heartbroken, feel like your brains and your blood's been soaking in a pool of regret. You just haven't gone for your truth yet, right? Right. I resolve to find the truth. Speak words that carry.
Back to Guerrilla Radio, CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria, 104.3 on the cable, cfuv.uvic.ca on the internet, everywhere else in the world. Playing behind me there, one of my favorites, Kenny Starr, Vancouver's own. Well, one watershed at a time. Vancouver Island is fast on its way to becoming a wasteland. This time, the wreckers have their eyes on Shaunigan Lake's watershed, where they plan what else but suburban sprawl into the already plundered forest lands. Typically, the systemic erasure of wild space is called development, but there are some telling differences with what's being planned around Shaunigan Lake. Mary Desmond is president of the Shaunigan Lake Watershed Watch Association, and she says this fight is about more than just losing natural habitat and a rural lifestyle. Welcome to the program, Mary.
Thank you.
Well, now, Mary, you call them Vandals West, and I can't agree more, but what is the dynamics that allow Timber West and other big timber companies working in BC to waltz into the real estate business and in the watersheds to boot?
Well, I suppose that they've squandered all their genuine timber equity by plundering all the old growth stands, and then they moved on to the second growth stands, and they've liquidated most of those. And the last few years, they've even started to demolish very immature timber stands, old trees in the age range of about 35 to 45 years old. So in order to keep their revenues up, they branched into the real estate market, which is proving, I suppose, to be a more lucrative ploy for them.
Well, now, these lands that they've cut all the trees from, this is something I've always had a very hard time understanding, but the government of the day in the way back let these guys onto, in many cases, government lands in return for the jobs that they promised and standards that they would uphold. Well, this all seems to be forgotten now. I don't remember the government ever saying, well, then, and after you're done, instead of replanting, you can plant townhouses instead of trees. How did we get to this point?
Well, local zoning is about the only kind of regulation in a municipal sense that supersedes senior level of government. And in the instance that you have mentioned, the Shaunigan Lake OCP is so obsolete, it's so out of date that when it was implemented over 20 years ago, no one ever anticipated that there would be such a demand for housing in this area. And even when the zoning is not in place and it's still registered and designated as forestry land in a municipal sense, timber companies and other independent developers are now doing is presenting these insidiously greenwashed proposals to local councils and municipal level governments. And some people are still at the stage where they can't detect the sting in the tail of these very prettily wrapped up proposals.
Right. Well, okay, so now, Mary, as president of the Shaunigan Lake Water Watch Association now, people might not connect. I mean, we all need water, of course, but people might not connect. There's a double whammy going on here. Not only are there more houses being built and more people being put into those houses in the Shaunigan Lake area, but the trees and watershed is being negatively affected by the clearing of the land for those houses. And not many people, I think, really are aware of the importance that forest and trees and greenery have in determining the quality of the water we get.
That's absolutely correct. Apart from the value of retention through root systems and crown canopies, some trees such as Douglas fir, their needles actually have the capacity to store water. And we have noticed some instances of plumes of that have obscured and made the water very murky here. And The loss of trees also affects the wetlands, which in their turn refine and regulate water flows. So in the last 2 years here, we've noticed pattern of alternating droughts and then very intensive, almost flood situations. And if those wetlands and those trees aren't in place, then we can only expect more of this, of the same. Now, TimberWest's latest proposal for 73 units on the flanks of Mount Wood, this is situated on sensitive recharge slopes of the watershed. So we are quite worried about that. And some may not be aware that around Shaunigan Lake is a ring of fractured bedrock, which means that any wells are highly vulnerable to surface contamination. So that's another point to consider.
Well, in some background information that you emailed to me over the weekend, you mentioned something, and again, you know, we just turn on the tap for the most part down here in Victoria and much of the Southern Island without really thinking much about it. But there's only for the whole South Island, which I don't know, the population is, I don't know, somewhere hovering around 500,000 by this point, I expect. We've got three major sources and three sources only, and that's the Souk source that Victoria depends on, the Cowichan Lake, and the Shaunigan Lake. And you say Souk seems okay, but these other two are threatened with contamination and what else?
Well, there's considerable degradation from housing. I'd say that's the number one cause of the decline in water quality. And I fear it's happening at Cowichan Lake, too, which is an immense lake, several times larger than either Shaunigan or Souk. And there's been quite a brutal assault with housing and suburbanization there as well. And in Shaunigan, of course, we all have heard for years stories, some of which happen to be true, about degradation caused by sewer systems. But people fail to realize that gray water seepage and stormwater drains can be just as damaging. And in fact, the runoff, especially from, antique, shall we say, sewer systems, and people fertilizing their lawns and trying to create a suburban effect with flower beds and lawns and so on. Now, this has really had a dreadful effect upon the lake, and it has resulted in the growth of what scientists call aquatic macrophytes, or weeds, some of which actually rob the lake of a crucial element, oxygen. And even when this is pointed out to people that perhaps, you know, spreading fertilizer on their lawn is not a good idea and actually contributes to the decline of the lake, they'll just go ahead and do it anyway because they want to preserve that suburban ideal. So what we really need is enforcement combined with education, because education alone just simply isn't sufficient.
Yeah, well, what we need is laws. I mean, there's long been talked about banning lawn and cosmetic fertilizers.
Right.
I mean, the effects are just enormous. And folks, please, just go pull your weeds. You know, if you have to have a lawn, or better yet, just grow vegetables.
Naturescape.
God's sakes. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Gorilla Radio on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria, 104.3 on the cable, and cfuv.uvic.ca on the internet and shoutcast everywhere else. I'm speaking tonight with Mary Desmond, and Mary is the president of the Shaunigan Lake Water Watch Association. Now, Mary, again, in some of the materials you sent me by way of preparation, you mentioned something that really piqued my interest. You've done a Freedom of Information request to try to find out what's going on behind some of these TimberWest developments. Can you relate your experiences with this request and the government's response to it?
Well, that was about almost 5 years ago now.
Oh, so this is the old news. Did you get it?
Eventually.
Uh-huh.
on patience is a virtue there. Eventually, after a good deal of publicity, including articles in the Vancouver Sun on related topics, the powers that be finally came through and dispensed the documents. And ever since that occasion, when we've had to request documents from the Ministry of Environment and other ministries, they have been more forthcoming, but they're still encountering delays, and some of the reasons given are pretty dubious. So Kelvin Sanborn of the Environmental Law Center at UVic was absolutely invaluable, he and his students in that fight.
Well, there's another connection to the University of Victoria, and you mentioned Dr. Azit Mazumdar. Who is Dr. M, as you call him, and what did he do for the Water Watch Association?
Well, he has been amazingly supportive with the scientific data and evidence to back our empirical observations regarding the decline in the water. And a couple of years ago, he gave a presentation here to the general public in Shawnigan, and I suppose the salient point there of his talk was that his research, which has been centered around a comparison between Duke Lake and Shawnigan Lake, because they're both very physically similar, was that he would rate Soup Lake a perfect 10 out of 10, whereas he would only assign a pretty questionable 6 out of 10 to Shawnigan.
This is for the quality of the potable quality.
Regarding water quality, right.
Yeah, okay.
And he noted further that with each passing year, the quality was deteriorating further.
It's been many years since I've been out to Shawnigan, but I recall being out there to water ski. This has got to be 20 years ago. And at that time, I remember all around the dock, there was nothing but gasoline in the water. How many people depend on Shawnigan Lake, do you know, for drinking water?
At least several thousand. The population of Shawnigan is presently around 8,500, though it's probably nudging up closer. No, to 9,000 or so, and then there are various other suppliers in Mill Bay who draw from the Shawnigan watershed system as well. There are around the lake 584 lots, and on which there are often more than one household, sometimes with a legal suite. And we counted in the sensitive ecosystem ring around the lake, and that would be, say, going houses situated on the water and perhaps one tier back, about 950 households. This was a few years ago, so doubtless there's more now. And most of these houses draw from Shawnigan. Some might have their own wealth, but most do draw from the lake.
Well,
pump it up.
What kind of laws are in place right now that protect the people and the quality of the watershed?
Not nearly enough, which is has been a tremendous source of vexation. I think the provincial government one. A response is so anemic, I get the impression they would simply like to sweep Shawnigan under the rug and forget about it. I know that Dr. Mazumdar has had meetings with Barry Penner, minister, when he was Minister of Environment, and Mr. Penner's attitude was that people could simply put up and shut up and wait until things got so bad here that there was genuine need for a filtration plant, which would cost $250,000. So it's been very disappointing, very frustrating in that sense. And where the municipal level government is concerned, that a development permit area that would legislate some of the activities around the lake, that's been dragging its heels, dependent upon the revision of the official community plan. So I rather suspect that things here will get worse before they get better.
Well, that's Barry Penner. He's still the environment minister, as I recall, and he was lauded by a local environmental, I'm doing air quotes around that, group here in Victoria, just recently, just before the election, in fact. You mentioned greenwashing of the issue of this development going on, and I'm speaking now particularly of Timber West. What kind of greenwashing are you experiencing?
Well, I suppose a prime example of that is Timber West Karma development just over the other side of the Malahat Ridge next door to us in Mill Bay, and that's a huge development of would-be 2,900 units, and that would be nestled cheek by jowl with Bamberton of about they keep changing the numbers, but a few months ago that was 3,200 units. And then on the other side of the Timber West proposal is a 1,200 unit Stonebridge development. It's almost the point that if one of these developments is approved, you worry that the others will follow suit too. And the greenwashing campaign in Bamberton has been quite adroit. What people don't realize is that once these lands are lost from the forest resource base, then they're lost virtually for forever, because once they're built on, their initial value escalates so that it's very difficult to reclaim these lands as a community.
Well, along with our super green environment minister, Mr. Penner, the British Columbia government has started up the Living Water Smart program and other water stewardship programs. Are you familiar with these?
Superficially. Because their response to Shaunigan has been so anemic. There was, about 9 years ago, when we had a director at Nanaimo Ministry of Environment in place, there was an integrated watershed management plan that was ordered for Shaunigan Lake. Then as soon as the provincial Liberals swept into power, that was never heard of again.
Well, Mary, we're fast running out of time. Can you tell us, our listeners, how, if they're interested in this issue, and they certainly should be, how they can find out more information about this?
Well, there are quite a few references on the internet and to our organization, and we do put out public materials in local shops and the libraries from time to time. The more who join and actually start to participate in their communities, the better it is for all of us.
And then again, you can, if you're doing a search, Shaunigan Lake Watershed Watch Association. Well, Mary Desmond, thanks a lot for coming on the program.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate it.
Well, it's my great pleasure, of course, and I do urge you to keep up the fight. It's an important one. I also want to thank Ezili Danto at EziliDanto.com, EziliDanto.com, for Haiti and what you might be able to do to help there. Thanks again, Mary, for being on the show.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. And, of course, Janine Mancroft and all the folks up here that make everything happen this week. That's all I got for you for this week. But good news, especially to jazz fans. Arnold's coming straight up with Rhythming to rhythm you into this springy day. Go down to View Street there by Cook and see the first of the cherry blossoms out. Till next time. Remove some ugly sores, and now I've begun to soar.
But I got such good luck that I stepped the fuck out the frying pan. See, I'm a good cook, right, man? Chili peppers, yeah, I'll take them. And juicy birds, alright, I'll bake them. Make up a soup, yum, yum, so we all can move along like culture. What's done is done, goodbye congestion. I just got one simple suggestion. Forsake the answer, rename the question. What lies...